Coming up.
The defense lawyer's job is to put the state to its proof.
Defending the guilty.
The prosecutor is supposed to seek justice, not victory.
Suing the faultless.
Legal ethics, an oxymoron?
The code of legal ethics, I mean, it's, you know, that's a blunt instrument.
Who does an attorney serve, the client or the law?
You know, as the lawyer, I want to say that, I'm a moral agent, too.
Balancing the client's interests and the interests of justice.
You know, you don't have a constitutional obligation to make sure that a murderer has a getaway car.
Our guest is David Lubin, author of Legal Ethics and Human Dignity.
You know, we could just do a trial by divination or trial by throwing horoscopes, but we got a procedure for finding out the truth, and we're not going to certify it as truth until it goes through that procedure.
Legal Ethics. Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
After the news.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW Loco and Innovative Public Radio for San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at that innovative little corner on the Stanford campus, Philosopher's Corner.
And from that oasis of thought, we migrate to this oasis of the air, and from the air to the internet, via our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where my pal and colleague John Perry's already started the conversation. And in the future, soon, we're going to also migrate to a podcast where you'll be able to download the past, present, and future, all the archives of Philosophy Talk very soon, right?
Yeah, now. Very soon, Ken. Hopefully soon enough that the podcast hasn't become a technology of the past. What's our problem here? Lawyers, lawyers.
They keep trying to dot the I's and cross the T's. We're trying to get this agreement, folks, but it's coming soon. But speaking of lawyers, our topic today, legal ethics. John, some people think that lawyers are the most ethically challenged professionals there are. What do you think?
Well, let's agree. No lawyer jokes for the next hour, right?
Well, few lawyer jokes.
I mean, I was raised in a house full of lawyers. Father, lawyer, uncle, lawyer, grandfather, lawyer. Most of my cousins are lawyers. I really admire lawyers. I think lawyers do something necessary for the public good. If you're going to live in a nation of laws, you've got to have lawyers to help you face those laws. And most lawyers, I think, are perfectly honest. They have a code of legal ethics. But sometimes lawyers seem to do things in their role as lawyers that are pretty morally onerous.
Well, yeah. Take a rape trial. The accusers on the stand. The victim's on the stand, and the defense attorney goes at her like crazy. This is not a pleasant thing to behold. Now, suppose that your wife or daughter or just a female friend of yours were raped, and you, just as an ordinary person, questioned her like that. What were you doing in that bar? What were you doing wearing that dress? Weren't you asking for it? Tell me about yourself. I mean, that would be morally repugnant for you or me or anybody else to do that. Why is it okay for a lawyer to do it?
Well, in my layman's mind, there's two kind of questions that come up about that. One is, what does the code of ethics say? Can a lawyer engage in that kind of behavior if they know that their client is guilty? Are they under any requirement to kind of find out if their client is guilty? Can they just suspend belief? Could a lawyer refuse to engage in that kind of conduct? So what's legal ethics require and what does morality require?
Right. Those are interesting questions. What is within the bounds of the lawyer's legal duties, and how far can the lawyer go, and does a lawyer have an obligation to truth? But suppose it's within the bounds of a lawyer's legal duties to zealously defend in that way this accused rapist. I mean, it's still morally problematic, isn't it? It's deeply morally problematic, at least morally fraught.
Well, it seems kind of weird. If I had gone down and broken Robert Blake out of jail, that would have been pretty bad, right? But his lawyer breaks him out of jail, assuming here that Robert Blake was probably guilty. Yeah. Why isn't that as bad?
It's a good question, you know, and it was nice to have a lawyer who actually deals with these things on the ground to talk to us about this. And our roving philosophical reporter, Zoe Corneli, found just such a lawyer. She files this report.
A real-life courtroom can be a messy place, and few people know that better than Santa Clara law professor Cookie Ridolfi.
Years ago, as a public defender, I represented a man charged in a rape case, and it was, pretty brutal case. He told me he was innocent, and, you know, I set out to try the case and did try the case before a jury.
Ridolfi was a public defender. Her job was to defend her client to the greatest extent permitted by the law. the client was accused of viciously raping and beating a woman who had been his dance partner at an adult club. He claimed the woman had invited him home for sex, and her husband was the one who beat her when he found the two of them together.
And it was a really highly contested case, and lots of feelings were running in all directions around this case, and ultimately he was acquitted.
Ridolfi says she did her best to argue her client's case, and the jurors found it convincing.
After the trial, the juror said to me, a woman juror came up to me and she said, you know, I know that a woman like you would never have defended him if he were guilty.
But within a few months, the defendant was arrested and convicted in two rape cases very similar to the one Ridolfi had tried.
And so that juror's comment came back and haunted me because I realized that, in fact, by the mere fact of my gender and probably her perception of me as a feminist, you know, in her mind, I was a witness for this defendant.
Ridolfi stopped defending rape cases after this experience, but she says she still believes the public defender plays an important role.
I don't want anybody to think that I wouldn't represent a man charged with rape because they're usually guilty and I can't bring myself to do something like that. I don't say that they're usually guilty. I think that there have to be good lawyers to represent people wrongfully charged, especially if somebody charged with something as serious as rape.
She says the real problem in our system is not letting people off who are actually guilty, but incarcerating people who are innocent.
Ethically, if we punish someone who's not guilty, then we're taking an affirmative act and depriving somebody of, you know, their liberty and maybe their life. In the other situation, if we don't punish someone or lock someone up who's a danger to society, No, I don't think we're doing as much damage.
Professor Ridolfi now spends her time helping people who claim they've been wrongfully convicted.
There is a huge problem of wrongful conviction in this country. This is the work that I do. I see it all the time. There are many more people wrongfully convicted than any one of us want to imagine. And a lot of what goes into wrongful conviction, I think, is certain expectations and biases and presumptions that if a person is charged with a crime, they're probably guilty.
For lawyers and jurors in the courtroom, Ridolfi says it's often difficult to know what's right.
You can, you know, get philosophical about this, and we can chat about this for weeks and weeks, which I know that there are scholars and books and articles written on these very issues. But, you know, the bottom line is we're not going to know whether we've released a guilty person and whether we've jailed an innocent person. You know, we're not going to know that for sure, so we want to have a system that's going to do the best job that it can at coming to the right result.
In the end, she believes, despite its flaws, the adversarial system is still the best model we've got.
It's not a perfect system. It never will be a perfect system. Until we have machines where you can put a person in and somehow, the truth, you know, comes out the other end. But we don't have that, and we never will have that. We have trials, and we have verdicts. So, you know, we have to hope that they're right most of the time, but there are errors, and there will always be errors.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Zoe Corneli.
Thanks, Zoe. I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
That was a powerful piece. We're joined today by David Lubin, who's the Frederick J. Haas Professor of Law and Philosophy at Georgetown. He's author of lots of stuff on this topic, including Lawyers and Justice and his forthcoming Legal Ethics and Human Dignity. David, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, well, it's great to be back with you.
Yeah.
Really enjoyed the last time that I was on, and I'm looking forward to talking with you again.
The last time you were on, you talked to us about war crimes, so heavy stuff you talked to us
about. Yeah, always crimes, though. But David, John Perry here, glad to have you back aboard. Look, let's start off by getting some facts straight. What exactly does the rigid code of ethics that lawyers have written for themselves require? We've talked about defense attorneys in the piece. Zoe and her guests talked about prosecutors and wrongful convictions. What are the rules here insofar as lawyers impose them on themselves?
In short compass, David.
Yep, in very short compass. Well, the one that's probably going to be the most surprising to listeners who aren't lawyers and who have the stereotype that the way that you tell whether a lawyer is lying is whether his lips move, is that there's a very strong rule that says no lying, no deceit, no misrepresentation. So that's on the side of what you can't do. The major duties Well, first of all, in the courtroom, the lawyer is supposed to be a zealous advocate for the client, which basically means that you do everything that the law permits on behalf of the client without really taking into account the interests of the adversary or third persons. I mean, you are your client's mouthpiece in the best sense. And the second big duty is the duty of keeping client confidences. The basic rule is anything about the client's past conduct is confidential. The only major exception to confidentiality is if the client is talking about some future crime or fraud, then the lawyer doesn't have to keep that confidential. In some states, the lawyer does.
David, just one question. The no lying, does that mean in the courtroom or does that mean throughout all the pre-courtroom processes and contractual negotiations and stuff?
Oh, it means everything. In fact, if you remember, Bill Clinton ended up losing his law license. Even though he wasn't the lawyer, he was the client. But he committed perjury, and he lost his Arkansas bar membership.
So no lying, you said. No lying is a little bit different from an obligation to speak and seek only the truth, right?
That's right. That's absolutely right.
You might wonder something. Why shouldn't that be the highest obligation of anybody in the courtroom? If the courtroom is a forum for speaking and seeking seeking the truth, then why shouldn't every party in the courtroom be obligated to seek the truth?
Well, Ken, I think that's a very good question, and I think that if I were going to be designing the system from scratch, I might want to put obligations like that on people. But the adversary system that we've inherited divides the courtroom into basically three different roles. There's the role of the judge or fact finder. That might be the judge, might be the jury, who is supposed to be the ultimate truth seeker. And then each of the two parties is presenting their own case. And the way that we've divided up the labor in the adversary system is that each one is only supposed to present their side of the case.
What are the alternatives, David? I mean, do other countries, in particular, countries generally like ours that conceive of themselves as republics and democracies, have different systems?
Yeah. In continental Europe and South America, the so-called civil law tradition, they've got a different kind of procedure. It's sometimes called inquisitorial, but that's a little bit misleading because it kind of makes you think of the pit and the pendulum and mm-hmm. torture. But what it really means is that it's kind of like a hearing where the judge is asking most of the questions. I mean, the clients and the lawyers get to ask some questions, but they take a backseat role, and it's pretty much the judge conducting an official inquest.
I want to ask you about our system, though. I want to go back to our system, and it's philosophical or whatever justification. You said if you were designing something from scratch, maybe you'd do it differently. And that sounds like it's just a historical contingency and we're stuck with this thing and it's not. But is there any deep philosophical justification for an adversarial system in which the lawyer is his or her client's mouthpiece? I mean, you might think, morality wants truth. You might think, well, look, zealous defense should be limited by truth somehow. I mean, that would be morally preferable. So an adversarial system is morally less preferable. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I think that the theory behind the adversary system is that the best way to get at the truth is it's kind of like the philosopher Karl Popper's idea that in science you put forward a conjecture, other people try to refute it. Conjecture, refutation. And I think that's the background theory behind the adversary system. So one side puts forward a proposition about the law or about the facts in the strongest possible terms. The other side then tries to refute it. And the idea is that way you maximize the input for both sides. Now, to me, the big problem with that, I think that's a beautiful idea in some contexts. Like if you're arguing purely points of law, like in front of the Supreme Court, then, I've talked with judges who say that they're always happier with a really strong presentation from both sides because it gives them more data and more to think about. The problem is at the trial level, when the adversarial lawyer's job isn't just to get more input into the system, it's also to try to manipulate to keep the other side's evidence and input out of the system if they possibly can. And my view is that kind of undercuts the justification of the adversary.
We're going to have to take this up in some greater depth, David, after a little break. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is legal ethics. Our guest is David Lubin from Georgetown University.
We've been talking about lawyers' ethical obligations under their own code of conduct, but how about morality? Aren't there some possible conflicts there? Codified legal ethics versus morality next.
And we invite you to join us by calling toll-free 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Legal ethics versus common morality, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
He saw the judge, now he's seen me. There's only one thing left. Will your lawyer talk to God for you?
Kitty Wells, the queen of country music, and Will Your Lawyer Talk to God? This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
I thought that the Dixie Chicks were the queens of country music. I'm Ken Taylor. Our topic today, legal ethics. We've got a lot of special folks in our audience, I know. I know there are some lawyers out there, and some of you have probably faced an ethical dilemma in your practice. How did you resolve it? Call in. Tell us your story, briefly.
And you non-lawyers as well. Maybe you've been screwed over by a lawyer, or you've admired the ethical acumen of some lawyer in your life. Is a lawyer's duty to his clients compatible with a duty to seek the truth? Tell us what you think. Legal ethics and morality, are they incompatible? The toll-free number is 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. And you can also email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest is David Lubin from Georgetown University. David, I want to focus in on possible conflicts and the lawyer's moral standing, right, when he or she carries out his ethical duties. So look, if I were to help a murderer in escaping punishment, you know, sort of outside the courtroom, I that would be morally reprehensible. So a lawyer whose client actually committed the murder and through his vigorous defense wins acquittal for a client, why isn't that as morally contemptible as my helping the murderer escape punishment?
Well, I think the idea is that there's a special morality that's associated with the role of the defender, and this is just one place where it's different from ordinary morality. You don't have a constitutional obligation to make sure that a murderer has a getaway car, but there is a constitutional obligation to make sure that the murderer, accused murderer, has a lawyer, and that's because otherwise we're worried that if you've got an alignment like the state versus Ken Taylor is one person. The state has a lot of resources, and we're worried about our rights. We want to see them protected, and we don't want prosecutors to be taking shortcuts or police to be getting on the stand and lying. So the defense lawyer's job is to put the state to its proof. Sure, maybe as the defense lawyer, I know that my client did it, but my client isn't supposed to be convicted unless it's proved beyond reasonable doubt, and my job is to test the state's proof.
Okay, so your job is to test the state's proof. Does that just morally excuse you from any consequences of being the agent, as it were, of a murderer going free and escaping punishment? Does that just completely excuse you from the moral demands of...
Take the lawyer we heard in our roving philosophical reporter segment. She obviously felt guilty about what had happened after she helped this guy that it turned out probably was guilty go free. Should she feel guilty?
Well, I think that she should feel some remorse about it. I don't know that she should feel guilty because the alternative would be that she doesn't defend the rapist, and the rapist goes to jail on the basis of a mere accusation. Maybe goes to jail for life on the basis of a mere accusation. So somebody's got to be there to test the state's case. And if the state's case isn't a strong one, then that person should go free, even if they were guilty of a crime.
Now, we've been talking a lot about defense attorneys, but how about the prosecutors? Doesn't the state
have some
responsibilities? How about copping pleas and all that stuff? There's a lot of abuses there, aren't there?
I think there are a lot of abuses. The prosecutor, at least in our system, has a different role. The prosecutor isn't supposed to be a complete kind of assassin. The way that the legal codes put it is that the prosecutor is supposed to seek justice not victory. And I think that this is very difficult because, you know, in real life, prosecutors, they get their reputations, their promotions, their the way that public confidence pretty much on the basis of how many scalps they have on their belt.
Join this conversation, 1-800-525-9917. We're talking about legal ethics. Right now we're talking about the possible conflicts between legal ethics and common sense morality. And Norm in Redwood City's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Norm.
Hi, thank you. I was a criminal defense attorney for many years. I think the wording you guys are using is a little slippery. The murderer that was guilty that you're talking about is not a murderer until a jury says he is a murderer. He's a presumed innocent. And defenders, if the person just says, hey, I'm guilty, the defense attorney's job is to get him the best deal he can, you know. Whatever the defense is, I did tons of criminal work, and I never really saw... Well, a few times you knew it was wrong, but usually the justice system works. But the judge and the jury, their job is the one to decide.
Now, wait a minute, Norm. I want to go back to the first thing you said. Now, if a guy shoots someone and kills them in cold blood with premeditation, they're a murderer, whether the jury said they're a murderer or not, aren't they? I mean, maybe as a matter of politeness or convention, we're supposed to call them an alleged murderer. But that doesn't change the fact that they're a murderer, does it?
Did you see them shoot the person in cold blood with and do you know it was premeditated? Did the person say to you, yeah, I decided I'm going to go over and shoot that person?
Let's make a distinction.
No, but they either are a murderer or they're not a murderer.
Let's make a distinction. David, tell me if I've got I'm doing this. Right. Thanks for the call, Norm. It raises an interesting and important question. So I want to make a distinction. John, I think you're not distinguishing enough. Let's call it real guilt or innocence, factual guilt or innocence, and then there's guilt or innocence in the eyes of the law. And the in the eyes of the law is all that the state can operate on. Because it has to have...
I think that's right. Yeah. The state is going to call this person an alleged murderer, an accused murderer, but as Norm says, a presumed innocent. But that doesn't mean that there is no truth out there. You know, I know this is sounding like an X-Files episode, that truth is out there. In some cases, there's just absolutely no doubt that the truth is out there. And there's some cases in which the defense lawyer really does know it as well as we know ordinary, everyday facts.
But look, I think there's a real double-edged sword here. If you think, oh, it's very good to say you're presumed innocent until you're proven guilty, and therefore you're not really a murderer, you're just an alleged murderer. But the flip side of that would be once you're decided you're guilty, there's no such thing as a wrong prosecution because everybody that's in jail was decided guilty, so they must be guilty. The facts are one thing.
John.
And there is no gainsaying the distinction between really doing it and not really doing it versus being judged to have done
John,
it.
I would like to go back to the second thing that Norm said because this is important. I mean, factually this person shot someone else. Do we know that person's a murderer? Well, not until we know were they defending themselves. Did they premeditate? The state might accuse them of a crime, but it's not clear that they've actually committed the crime. I mean, even if we do know for a fact that they've committed the killing. And one of the jobs of the defense lawyer is to make sure that prosecutors aren't playing fast and loose with criminal charges, overcharging because the case is sensationalistic,
right.
Or sometimes a prosecutor will overcharge in order to terrify somebody into copping a plea in order to avoid the death penalty.
So, David, the defense lawyer has the job, and it's an important job, of sort of keeping the prosecution to its paces, making the prosecution do justice in a way. I mean, if the prosecution were left unconstrained without the defense attorney there, justice might the state might run over people. And so that's a real problem. Let's some more callers in here. Steve in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Steve.
Hi, guys. Why don't we, try and perhaps deal head on with a sort of underlying issue, which I think philosophers just, assume is out there, which is that there's no underlying truth in what you got are theories. And so, even the way science works is you throw out theories, as you say, and then people go out and falsify them.
How do they falsify them if there's no such thing as truth?
If you got a hypothesis on how the universe operates, and then you find you do experiments to find out stuff that's inconsistent with that hypothesis.
Well, inconsistent means that those results can't be true and the hypothesis true. They can't both be true. So the notion of truth is right at the bottom of this whole process.
Yeah, John, you're sounding like a defense attorney. Thanks for the call, Steve.
I'm defending truth.
David, what do you think? Does the legal system presuppose that there's no underlying truth?
No, the legal system, I think, does presuppose that there is an underlying truth. I mean, after all, otherwise, you know, we could just do a trial by divination or trial by throwing horoscopes. But, you know, we do try to design evidence rules in a pretty rational way to try to weed out the false from the true. But what the legal system does presuppose, and I think this goes back to both of the last two questions, is that we got a procedure for finding out the truth, and we're not going to certify it as truth until it goes through that procedure.
Well, it seems to me philosophically, to have a reasonable philosophy of law, we got to have this distinction between alleged guilt and real guilt. But to have a fair system, we have to really push how difficult it is to know and how important it is not to judge before you know. How we do that without slipping into this relativism and believing there isn't any real truth, that's what I worry about.
I think you're right about that. But then, again, it goes back to something. Look, if our confidence that there is a real truth and that truth is hard to achieve, I mean, you could say that's why we have this adversarial system, right? It's because we think it best serves the hard task of trying to achieve the truth because it says that, you know, the defense attorney is going to mount every possible argument on behalf of his side, and the prosecution has to counter those arguments. And only if you have somebody who has a kind of argumentative stake on every possible rational side are you going to get out of this process convergence of truth.
The metaphor also suggests the dangers, right? I mean, if you have a lightweight going out there against a heavyweight, you're not going to do very good. And so the adversarial system brings with it the idea that the money and the heaviness and the weight and the power of the guy you got fighting for you is going to be very determinative.
What do you think, Dave?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, I know that you said no lawyer jokes, but there is a legal system joke, which is that, you know, what's a trial? It's a, you know, 12 men and women trying to decide who had the better lawyer, and that's not what we want.
No, that's not what we
want. So my problem with the adversary system is that if it is something in which we're trying to get at the truth, you know, it puts lawyers under this obligation of zeal that sometimes leads them to take steps to suppress the truth. So let's just move away for a minute from the criminal trial to, you know, a civil trial. It's a true case. It involved a major pharmaceuticals company in the early 1970s that was making an intrauterine contraceptive device, an IUD, called the Dalcon Shield. And the Dalcon Shield had a defect. It sterilized 9,000 women. And the company, in the face of all of these lawsuits that were threatening to put it under, decided to use a real scorched earth litigation tactic. And it became famous. It was known by all the lawyers who were practicing this in the country as the dirty questions list. So they would get the victim in a deposition, which is asking the questions before the trial to sort of pin the person down on paper, and ask incredibly personal and embarrassing questions about the woman's sexual practices and her sexual partners. Questions like, "Give us a list of all your sexual partners other than your husband." One woman said, "I'll answer your questions, but this is sounding more like an obscene phone call than a deposition." And, of course, the purpose of the dirty questions list was to intimidate these women so that they would drop their lawsuits because they didn't want to have to answer these questions, you know, which were about intimate physical practices in a lot of cases. And I don't think I want to go into that on the radio.
Yeah, no.
They didn't want to answer them in open court.
You think the legal ethics, the code of legal ethics, should somehow have said that was out of bounds. These lawyers shouldn't have been allowed to do that. Is that what I'm hearing?
Well,
here?
I'm not sure that this is one for the code of legal ethics rather than for the moral obligations of the lawyers, because the code of legal ethics, I mean, it's, you know, that's a blunt instrument. It's very hard to say, don't ask this kind of question, but do ask this kind.
But
it's very hard to draw that boundary.
But wait a minute. But if it's not for the code of legal ethics, and it's for some external thing, the ordinary moral code, let's call it that, then doesn't that say to a lawyer, you know what, constrain your defense of your client by sort of the considerations of morality, even when the ethical code permits it. But if I'm the client, I would say, look, if these ethically fraught things are permitted by the legal code and by the law, then I want you to deploy them. Otherwise, you're not being fully my advocate.
Well, I think that that's what the client's going to say. But, you know, as the lawyer, I want to say that, you know, I'm a moral agent, too. I'm not going to do just anything on your behalf. Ironically, we always think that the biggest problem is with the criminal defense lawyer who's getting the guilty person off. To me, that's the one in which the lawyer is under the strongest obligations to do whatever it takes, you know, as long as it's legal. It's these other cases, like the Dalkon Shield case, where we're not talking about saving somebody's liberty from the state, but, you know, we're talking about defeating somebody's claim for money.
Okay.
That's where it seems to me that the lawyer's got to be a real autonomous moral agent and say, you know, there's some things I just won't do.
1-800-525-9917. Join our conversation. And Michelle in Redwood City's on the line.
Hi, John and Ken. How are you?
Okay.
Just fine.
What's your comment or question, Michelle?
I used to be in the prosecutor's office. And I think what John was talking about before, there's a distinction between the legal truth and the truth in reality. And sometimes we just had cases where, even though, you know, you had a very strong suspicion that he did it or she did it, you just couldn't prove. You couldn't prove your evidence. You couldn't put in the evidence to a legal certainty, and you couldn't convict the person. So I think sometimes it goes both ways. And even though it may be a reality in fact that someone shot a person or someone raped a person, it's very difficult sometimes to prove.
Michelle, let me ask you a question. Why, in the common imagination, people think defense attorneys are slime because they get guilty people off. I mean, I suspect that as many innocent people are wrongly convicted as guilty people are let go. And why don't people think prosecutors are slime?
Well, I mean, if you watch TV, you probably do think prosecutors are slime. I want to ask our caller who's had experience of it. I mean, how do prosecutors feel about the risk of putting an innocent person in jail?
They worry about that, but they also worry about not being able to convict people who they really believe did it. There's just not enough evidence to prove to the legal standards that they did what they're charged with doing.
But on TV, the prosecutor in that case will usually manufacture some evidence or something like that. You don't really do that, do you?
One would hope not. One would hope not.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing legal ethics with David Lubin from Georgetown University.
Next, we're going to talk about the social costs and benefits of having a profession whose ethical code may sometimes require things that would be immoral for the rest of us.
Are lawyers ethical martyrs or instruments of the rule of law or latter-day sophists who make the weaker argument the stronger? Plus, more of your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Out of this. Ha! Send lawyers, guns, and money.
Warren Zevon, lawyers, guns, and money. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything
except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We haven't had many lawyer jokes, but we had lots of good lawyer songs. We're discussing legal ethics with David Lubin. David, I'm going to give you a thought. So look, lawyers have to do morally problematic, but some, I think, absolutely essential work, right? Sometimes defending morally reprehensible people, they have to do this so that the rest of us can benefit, have the benefits of living in a society governed by the rule of law. But their morally problematic things really are morally problematic. So does that make lawyers, I want some sympathy for lawyers, kind of moral martyrs, right? They have to be morally fraught in order for the rest of us to enjoy law-governed societies?
Well, I don't know if that makes lawyers moral martyrs. I mean, if they're moral martyrs, then why are they smiling so much?
Because they're well paid.
Well, remember the lady who was interviewed by the Roving Philosophical Reporter. She really suffered because of what she did, and perhaps was obliged to do given the trial. So, moral martyrs. I mean, very few of them get thrown to the lions.
But what do you think, though, David?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I think that there are real moral costs involved in a role that is going to pit you against, everyday common sense Sunday school morality. I mean, it's a less extreme version of problems that face soldiers. I mean, a soldier may have to kill somebody in the line of duty, and an awful lot of soldiers feel tremendous remorse. They have a hard time living with themselves afterwards, and I think that especially in litigation practices in law, after a while it begins to take its toll on the lawyers. And I think that some of them really end up with that kind of sense of martyrdom.
Well, an emailer, Alex, puts it rather well. He says, for instance, on an individual level, it seems wrong for a lawyer to defend a client even if she knows her client is guilty. But as regards the system as a whole, it is in all of our best interests that we get the strongest defense we possibly can. That's a good point. Is it true that people really believe it's true these days? When our government, when our nation was founded, there was a lot of distrust of the government. That's kind of more, you mentioned before about the difference between the British system and the common law system and the civil system. That's kind of the British American distrust of big government is in there. But nowadays, when you look at the reactions to some of the things that have happened over the last 6 years, do people really distrust government all that much? I mean, do they really think that it's better for 10 people to get off free than for one innocent person to go to jail? What do you think?
Yeah, I think that especially when it comes to terrorism issues, that's not the attitude that people have. And in my view, it's unfortunate because I think that there have been some tremendous prosecutorial abuses involved in going after terrorists. And it, partly it's because we have government officials and government lawyers who stand up and make what seems like a common sense argument. Why should terrorists have rights to fair trials or whatever? And the answer is, the fair trial is the way that our society has decided to figure out whether somebody's a terrorist or not.
Well, the point our callers made earlier, they're just alleged terrorists. I mean, what we should say.
We've got time for one last caller here who I think wants to bring a discordant note here. Paul in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Paul.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. It seems to me that the key distinction here is between a fact on one hand and knowledge of a fact on the other hand. And it seems to me that a primary function of a court is to ascertain knowledge of a fact or a set of facts. And that's the distinction that I think people have sort of been, dancing around and talking about, does a court actually create a truth or does it seek the truth? I mean,
Paul, I thought somebody told me you wanted to say that that lawyer's ethics is a license to do whatever they can get away with.
Okay, so that all right. Well,
you're changing the topic.
My second comment is that at the beginning of the show, your guest stated that lawyers have an obligation to do everything that the law permits in the pursuit of their client's interests, and it seems to me that that specific obligation is inherently problematic because basically what that means to me is that an attorney should basically do whatever she can get away with. And what that, comes down to is an individual making a decision about whether, what an attorney does is acceptable or not. But, it seems to me that you can't really be moral in the sense of, say, not engaging in underhanded tricks when you are supposed to basically try to do whatever you can get away with.
Okay, Paul, we've got your point. Thanks a lot. David, what do you think? Does a lawyer really have a license to do whatever he can get away with?
Well, license to do means, does the law going to forbid him from doing it? Get away with here means doing something legal. So put in those terms, the answer is no. But I actually agree with Paul. I think that in real life, a lawyer whose client says, I want you to do something that's absolutely despicable because it's good for me, it advances my interest, lots of times that lawyer will sit with the client in the office and say, you're a damn fool. I'm not going to do this. The thing is, we never find out about those conversations because they're in the privacy and confidentiality of the lawyer's office. But, every good lawyer, I think, spends a lot of time talking clients out of morally reprehensible schemes. So, I mean, lawyers are supposed to be objective people who are giving some independent judgment, and clients come in sort of filled with desires and greeds and passions. Sometimes the lawyer's job is to cool them down.
So you just gave us another justification for, say, the legal duty of confidentiality, because it enables the lawyer not just to be the advocate for the client, but as it were, a counselor to the client, right?
Yeah, and I think that the job of counselor and advisor is one that's incredibly important. And, ultimately, it may be even more important than the job of advocate because, most lawyers actually aren't courtroom lawyers. They're deal makers or paper pushers or compliance counselors.
I want to ask you a big question. We're getting toward the end here with you, but there's a big question. I love our Constitution. But we said law, the courtroom is supposed to be a forum for seeking truth, which is hard to find. You know, if there was something missing in our Constitution that is present, wouldn't it be easier to seek the truth? That is, if we could call on the defendant and say, tell us what happened under oath, as in a civil trial, if you could do that in a criminal trial, wouldn't truth be... So why do we let people shut up?
No Fifth Amendment, is that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that's...
I know
really
we have it, but why do we have it?
Yeah. Well, you know, one reason that is given is that if you don't have it, then it gives the authorities an incentive to put people through the third degree to make them talk. This way, if you give them a right not to talk, then it takes away the incentive for the backroom third degree. But I think there's an even more important reason, and that is that we've decided, for better or for worse, that there's something demeaning to human dignity about making somebody be a witness against themselves, which is what the words that the Constitution uses,
right.
That it's a kind of forcing somebody to give up the role of their own self and take on the role of the accuser. And there's a kind of split there, that split personality that it imposes on us, that's an offense against human dignity.
I mean, it's a complicated thing, and unfortunately we're going to have to end it on this complicated note, but there's competing goods. Respect for dignity,
right.
and the full-bore pursuit of the truth, and we make some compromises to get both of these things in there, right? What do you think?
That's absolutely right.
Well, on that note, David, I'm going to have to thank you for joining us. It's been a great conversation, and we just barely scratched the surface. Maybe we'll have to have you back again sometime.
Well, it's a real pleasure. Great to talk with you guys again.
Our guest has been David Lubin, Frederick J. Haas Professor of Law and Philosophy at Georgetown University, author of Lawyers and Justice and the forthcoming Legal Ethics and Human Dignity.
We want to thank all the callers we didn't get a chance to. We've got a nice long list of them, I'm afraid, as we close, and we didn't get to all of our emails either. Thanks a lot. You make a contribution by just calling and emailing.
Yeah, there's a lot of smart folks out there in this audience. You know, there's a great audience. So what did you learn? I know you started out loving lawyers. You probably still do, coming from a family of them.
Yes, I have a pretty positive conception of the role that lawyers play in society, and I think the vast majority of lawyers are helpful, honest, slightly overpaid people doing their job. Actually, you know, as you know, Ken, maybe our listeners don't know, we usually actually put a little time in reading before we have these shows. We have students at Stanford that help us pick out things off the internet and from books. And it was very interesting to read some of what our guest said about the concept of human dignity in the law. I wish we'd gotten to that a little bit more. He has some very interesting ideas.
Yeah, very, very interesting. He's got a forthcoming book on this subject, and you should pick it up when it's out, because this long article about ethics and legal ethics and human dignity, it's really fascinating. But, you know, I do think lawyers, a lot of what they have to do is morally fraught, and I do think we don't excuse them, right? So they're often in moral peril, but they're in moral peril sort of for society's sake. I heard a mercenary, of all people, being interviewed on the radio not too long ago, and he said, we do the work that is absolutely essential to be done, but you wouldn't want your ordinary citizens or even your ordinary soldiers do it. You wouldn't want it acknowledged. We do it in the dark of night, but it has to be done. Well, lawyers are a little bit like that, don't you think?
Yeah, I think that there's truth in that, and in a way, I think that's true of politicians. Any very powerful person gets themselves in a situation where the consequences of their acts may be enormous, and such that if an individual person were to do that many things, the guilt would just be overwhelming.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can say whatever you want about the president. His decisions have affected millions of people. And he, you know, in a way, he's a martyr.
So this conversation continues on our blog. John's already started it, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore, I blog.
Hey, Ken, is that the Fifth Symphony I hear starting?
No, that's not the Fifth Symphony. It's my favorite time of the show. It's conundrum time, John. And we've got a caller on the line now. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you.
And what's your name and where are you calling from?
My name is Osher, and I'm calling from Eugene, Oregon.
Eugene, Oregon, home of Oregon State University, home of the great philosopher Bill Ugalis and all his friends. Well,
so, Osher, what do you do up there in Eugene, Oregon?
Eugene, Oregon.
A school teacher. What grade do you teach?
Sixth graders.
Ah, good for you, Osher. Good for you.
You know, Osher, you have my sympathies.
So, Osher, why don't you tell us about your conundrum?
It's a question of justice. I was called for jury duty last summer The court case involved a boyfriend who, in a jealous rage, briefly strangled his girlfriend, just for a moment. Then the couple got back together, and she wished to drop the charges. The state prosecuted nevertheless. We and the jury found him guilty. It was open and shut case. However, not only are they back together and she wishes to drop charges, but it seems to be genuinely an isolated case, not an abusive pattern. So I'm wondering, in helping to find him guilty and use the state apparatus against him, what have I done? How was justice served?
You did your duty. It's important that it's the people versus the defendant. It's not the victim versus the defendant. So it's the state apparatus. We all, on the victim's behalf, stand behind the state in prosecuting and giving a fair trial to the defendant, right? So if somebody robs me, I say, I could bear to lose that money. Don't prosecute it. And that's not right, because it's not just about me. It's about impersonal, impartial justice, and the state is supposed to be the organ of that. Well, what do you think, John?
Well, I think, of course, I agree with a lot of what Ken says, but let me shift to a more philosophical question here. Take this hypothetical. Suppose you're on a jury, and it's a very strange circumstance. You agreed to be on the jury. You didn't think you knew the witness, but as the trial progressed, for one reason or another, you came to realize two things. First, that this guy that's being tried is innocent. Let's say it's a murder. He didn't do it. Somehow you found out who did it quite offline, so to speak. On the other hand, you know for a fact, absolutely certain, that he's committed many murders for which he's never been able to be convicted, and that it would be a wonderful thing if he were removed from society. And let's throw in a third thing. You know that nobody else will know that you know these things. Should you convict him and remove him from society, or should you stick to your juror's oath and find him innocent, even though you're pretty sure he'll go out and kill some more people and probably get off scot-free? What do you think about that case?
I would find him guilty.
You would find him guilty. In other words, you'd say, well, you know, the jury system is fine as a set of guidelines, but in this case, I'm going to do what I know brings about the best effects.
Oh, jeepers.
So, you're a utilitarian.
I think you are a juror. You are not God. You are not the neutral arbiter of justice. You do your role, right, in a system that has a complicated structure. When juries start trying to be the neutral arbiter of justice kind of all on their own, I think the whole system goes haywire.
But there's a lot of cases where a juror may realize, because he's got more moral principles than the state, that the law is completely unjust. I have the power with me to in my life to get on the jury and see that a deeper justice is done than the law calls for. Suppose you were sure. Suppose you were certain that this was an isolated case. Maybe you have a background. You can really see that it had to do with, you know, some guys, when they drink creamed mint, they just go berserk. And as long as they stay away from that particular liquor, there'll never be another problem. You know that.
But I don't know. Often victims of abuse, of spousal abuse, are self-deceived. They believe that it's not going to happen again, that the person's reformed, that they're willing to get back together. But they're often self-deceived. You know, I have a brilliant student who wrote a brilliant thesis about this, who taught me all kinds of stuff about self-deception. Self-deception is rampant in just cases like this. And I don't know. I don't think you should take her word that it's not going to happen again. I don't think she should take her own word that it's not going to happen again. And B, I don't really believe that. I believe in the tradition of civil disobedience, but civil disobedience in the jury room can be a very pernicious thing. That's what I think. So what do you think, Asher?
Food for thought. We'll have to mold this over.
Yeah. Thanks, Asher. Enjoy talking to you.
Likewise. Thank you very much.
If you have a philosophical problem or quandary that's affecting your work or your play or keeping you awake at nights, John and I would be happy to lend an ear and maybe give you some sound advice.
Go to the Philosophy Talk website and poke the conundrums button with your mouse, or just send an email to conundrums@philosophytalk.org. Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2006.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Special thanks to Devin Strolovich, Neil Van Leeuwen, Ben Temption, and Mark Stone. Our senior consulting producer is Gordon Earle.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University.
Also from the Friends of Philosophy Talk and the members of KALW Local Public Radio, San Francisco. where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.